And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Would someone please step up and get this planetary thing headed in the right direction? Please? At times, it feels like humanity's midlife crisis, old enough to know better, and young enough to want to hold on to our youth. But this is getting old, and we seem to be heading into a vortex of unknowing. Today, we're heading into the Matrix, mixing wonder and worry, people and plunder, with the hope that we dust off the light to see the road ahead. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
From my perspective, there's just way too much happening on the planet. Everybody is in everybody's business, and that was always a recipe for disaster. The old too many cooks spoiling the stew sure holds here. Trouble is, we are the ingredients in the stew we call right now. The trouble is that the ancient visionaries who wrote about the future were right. Jules Verne and Captain Nemo and his atomic-powered self-sustaining submarine that roamed 20,000 leagues under the sea and tried to stop the destruction of the planet by greedy lords and masters by ramming and sinking ships to get their attention? What about on the beach, when threats of nuclear exchange turn hot, leaving only a handful of humanity wondering what it means? The question of today, will North Korea launch their missile? Will they have nuclear weapons? And what about Iran and their desires? It brings a whole new meaning to the term nuclear family. Well, everyone knows that families are rough, and maybe that's the point. With 24/7 news bringing us the latest visions of death, madness, and mayhem, it gets hard to really feel good about our future. The peacemakers keep losing. So who reads Gandhi, or King, or Kennedy, or Lenin, John Lennon, that is? We just may be reaching critical mass destruction. And then we hear the great news, and we've got some exciting good things to report, like some recent discoveries of magic little creatures that assure us we hardly know this Earth, and the news that the president has created the largest marine reserve on Earth. We all need to pray now that there is absolutely nothing of value there, like oil or some exotic mineral, just a bunch of miraculous sea life and beauty. And oceans are in the news from another's perspective. Today, following the news, we bring you up to date on the events in St. Kitts, where whaling is back on the table, literally. In our second segment, we talk about the weather with one of America's favorite weather guys, who's tracked tornadoes, hunkered down in hurricanes, and gives his perspective on global warming. Then in segment 3, one of the first real outcomes of the right-leaning Supreme Court pretty much validates what many of us who value the living systems have worried about as they begin to dissect the waterways literally and legally. It's all coming up. It's a great show looming. So let's forge ahead with the news. So now, the news. The International Whaling Commission, the IWC, meeting in St. Kitts in the Caribbean, strongly urged oil companies and nations to reconsider the use of high-intensity sonic devices to locate underwater oil reserves, as research is proving that the damage to marine creatures is often dramatic. At the same meeting, following the lead by Japan and Norway, the IWC managed to craft a 33-32 vote to remove the ban on whaling that has been in place for 20 years. Although the vote will not remove the ban, which requires a three-quarters vote of its members, this first-ever majority indicates a challenge to what has been a relatively worldwide effort to stop whaling, which have decimated whale populations around the world. We'll be looking into this story more during today's show. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to overturn a lower court's decision, which put a stop to two development projects on private lands, as the lower courts determined that the projects violated the 1972 Clean Water Act. The court's decision, following liberal and conservative divisions of the justices, effectively opens up the prospect of many future cases over similar interpretations. We will be going in-depth on this topic in our third segment. The Bush administration approved requests from three eastern governors to bar commercial logging in remote sections of national forests in the states of North Carolina, South Carolina, and Washington. The administration used the sanctions of these grants to make the case that they have always been green, just unrecognized. The three governors requested that the roadless status of their forests be protected under the 2001 rules initiated under the Clinton administration. Many environmentalists believe a more significant test of the administration's green spirit may occur if and when requests for roadless protections come from lumber-rich states. Scientists were regaling the discovery of three new lemur species in the wilds of Madagascar. These tiny primates, which are early relatives of we humans... Psst! Notice the little hands on the picture on the website. Exist only in Madagascar, which is home to 70 lemur species. The poverty-stricken nation is struggling to set up protections to safeguard at least some of the extraordinary diversity of species. The government has committed to tripling the amount of protected space to 6 million hectares in an attempt to refashion its future based on ecotourism. President Bush this week announced the creation of the world's largest marine preserve, embracing the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. The reserve, which protects 140,000 square miles, is an area the size of California and is home to more than 7,000 marine species, many of which are found only in these waters. The area is also home to millions of seabirds and endangered animals, including the monk seal, one of the world's most rare sea mammals. The area, designated as a national monument, provides even greater protection than would be available under the marine sanctuary protections. Some are regaling this as the first imprint by the new Treasury Secretary, who moved over from his position directing Goldman Sachs, and who is a strong environmentalist, having served as president of the Nature Conservancy. And speaking of conservancy, Norway announced that it is establishing the world's largest seed bank, deep inside a heavily fortified and protected 70-meter tunnel. The seed bank will hold 1.5 billion seeds and 3 million varieties and is set up as protection to plant forms on Earth should environmental or astronomical disasters such as meteor strikes or other phenomenon destroy portions of the genetic diversity. The location was chosen both for its remoteness, which protects it against unwanted intrusions, and because it maintains a relatively constant temperature of minus 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit, the perfect incubator for long-term holding. Therefore, for those keeping score, Norway this week has one on the positive side for the seed bank and one on the negative side for its whale whacking. Come on, Norway, you can do better. And that's the news. A few reminders. Noticed anything different about the Wild Side News webpage? We just did a facelift of our webpage and hope you like your new Voice of the Earth portal. It's like any place you've lived in for a while. It gets a bit cluttered and stuff starts piling up in the corners. Well, we took it all away and have a brand new brand. You can now more easily do a quick search of topics like saving the planet or parks or recreation, and yet the good old archives are still there. Take a fresh look around. I'll bet you'll see a lot of things that will get your attention. And please, now that we've tidied up a bit, invite your friends in for a visit. Thanks. Whales. One of the things I've come to know is that all the creatures in my world are out there looking to communicate, to show off, to play, to be important, and live as long as they can. Those little lemurs we talked about, here they are, not having seen a scientist before, and they're just hanging out, curled up comfortably on a finger, smiling and wonder, hey, what's next? Or my cockatiel, or the neighbor's cat who walks along the edges, or your dog, or even the rabbit nibbling on your new vegetable shoots. This is our Eden. But whales, mammoth mammals, gentle creatures, swimming in schools of friends, caring for the children, singing across the seas, leaping free and grand. They're smart. Go to SeaWorld and talk with one of the swimmers who stand on their nose and get projected high into the air for all to see. In 1986, the world agreed that humans had to stop killing these creatures, not only because we were about to wipe them from the history books of wonder, but also because maybe they had a right to be. And so the International Whaling Commission, the IWC, banned the killing of whales, and since then, the whales have managed to sustain. Thank God. But Japanese have eaten whale as part of their culture. Many thank the whale for being one of the few food sources following the devastation of the atomic bomb blasts of World War II. So, they ate more whale than before. And that old guard developed a taste for whale. And despite the fact that the IWC provided an allowance for scientific research on whales, Japan had a hunger for whale. And so they boosted their research to kill upwards of 1,000 whales a year. And their hunger for knowledge fed their hunger for whale. And to this day, in restaurants around Japan and in markets, whales are diced and flinced into edible chunks and turned into soup and fried blubber. It's an industry, they say, this research. And so in the name of science, Japan this week harpooned the hopes of the human spirit by dealing out big scoops of money and promises to nations like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, who really don't hunt whales, but nevertheless voted with Japan and Norway and Greenland to reopen whaling. And they set a landmark, squeezing out a one-vote majority in St. Kitts this week to lift the ban. And though it requires a three-quarter majority vote to overturn the ban, the politics of plunder will be working their unseen sinews to tie up the votes in the years ahead. It's that old midlife crisis lurking. Humanity, feeling clearly that the spirit of whales is too big to sink with exploding harpoons. And yet somehow, we keep losing. Humanity does. Who speaks for us? How do we speak? That just may be the decision we face as we determine what we want for the rest of life on Earth. Chart your course, set your sails, festoon yourself with the weapons of the caring warrior, and fight for life. One of Japan's leading whale specialist restaurants is called Tarayuchi. Tarayuchi. Its legendary owner, Takashi Sato, had this to say about our cause. Whale is a traditional Japanese food and is part of the Japanese culture. Who cares what the anti-whaling lobby may have to say? But those are the facts. Mr. Sato, I'm not an anti-whaling advocate. I'm a friend of the whale. Stop killing my friends. I leave you with a song by one of the finest voices of the earth, who sang tribute to the grace and wonder of whales. Eliza Gilkison. Give our grief.
more than we'll ever need. And still we're so blind. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand? Oh, creatures unseen land, before it's too late. Shadows and footprints mirror the movements of moon and tide. Magnificent families glide perfectly calm, nurturing children. Hands. They're part of a perfect plan, and brother to man. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand? Oh, creatures on sea and land, before it's too late.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One down, and no one knows how many more. Welcome to the year one post-Katrina. As we speak, Houston, Texas is roiling in floodwaters, while coastal communities look skyward, tune on their radios, and wait. There was a time when it was always safe to talk about the weather. Not anymore. We go inside the mind of a meteorologist to find out what's up with the weather these days, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Shadows and Footprints, an anthem to the wonder. Eliza Gilkison wrote that song and sang it. She integrates that wisdom into every song she writes. So I thank you, Eliza, for letting me play it, and I encourage all of you to go to her website at elizagilkison.com. That's ElizaGilkison.com. And then just buy one of everything, because you deserve it. Shadows and Footprints was from her Pilgrims album, which unfortunately is out of print and hard to find. But Eliza is touring around the country these days, a lot around Austin, Texas, and those haunts and hollers. There is something magic that happens when Eliza performs. Do yourself a favor and make Eliza Gilkison part of your life. Speaking of Texas, this week, Houston got whacked with an enormous storm that turned that humid city into a soppy mess. Is this normal, or is there something about the weather that we just don't know? We're about to take a ride with a weatherman who knows which way the wind blows. Weather's in the news all the time. It, as far as I can tell, may just be the topic of the 21st century. It's fascinating. It's scary. It affects all of us, and according to many, many people, it's going to conceivably affect us in ways that we just haven't experienced before. This based on some of the talk about global warming, or as I like to put it, global weirding. Well, there's someone who thinks about weather, lives within it, chases it, has a lot of fun with it, and he's joining us now. And his name is Mark Hoeksema. He's a chief meteorologist with a company called Weatherbug, which you can find at weatherbug.com. Mark, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thanks for having me.
First of all, I think you have a really interesting career. It sounds like you have a lot of fun. And Mike, how long have you been actually working in the weather industry?
So, let's see, I started working at a television station, NBC station in Washington, D.C. in 1986.
Well, did you ever think that your career would end up being the hottest subject of the 21st century?
It kind of became apparent shortly after I started my first job when you found that TV ratings would go through the roof whenever there was a weather catastrophe, that everyone needed to know what the weather was. The highest ratings period during a newscast was always centered around the weather broadcast portion. And, you know, that started making it pretty apparent that my interest went beyond just me being a weather geek. It's more what people, you know, generally, you know, they live their lives by it and they're absorbed by it.
You're absolutely right. I can recall that when I was growing up, we'd be listening to the news, but when the weather came on, my father let everybody know everyone was to just plain shut up because he needed to listen to the weather. He was a gardener, and that was really important to him. Well, this is fascinating because you've been at this now for, looks like 20
yep.
years or more.
Yeah.
And so you really have had a chance to watch what's happening in the weather, and I bet you can know where I'm going with this. A lot of people, well, global warming, I like to say it's global weirding, is a huge issue. Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, actually has just, you know, it's a box office mm-hmm. success. Who would have thought such a thing would be possible? And what everybody is kind of the debate, I don't think anyone is debating any longer whether or not global warming is happening, but the question would be, are you able, over 20 years of watching the weather, to really see some sort of difference?
Well, I mean, definitely, it's hard to not say that global warming is happening. There's just entirely too much evidence. And over the years, I can honestly say I have seen, you know, the full extent of weather where you go, that is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen record highs set at 3 a.m. I've seen the biggest snowstorms ever on the East Coast, the worst hurricanes ever, just when you thought it was the worst with Andrew, you know, it's the worst with another one. And then last year, it was like the next storm was always the worst one.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff going on with what I look at over my experience is the media attention of weather, which brings a lot of what's going on to life for people, whether it be, you know, the hottest summer on record or a severe snowstorm. My view on global warming and such is more about how it's being communicated to people. I see the back and forth with the pros and the cons, and it really, that the way scientists and then in the end the media covers it is, I think it's done a disservice through a lot of claims that confuse the public, when in the end I think the public needs to know that global warming is occurring, and it's likely enhanced by human interaction with the environment. But the constantly being told that one study says this will happen and another study says that will happen ends up confusing the real issue, which is, you know, global warming. You can tell someone that in 10 years no crops will grow in the plains to get people's attention, but what it'll do in the end is, if it doesn't happen, then someone who really needs to know that this is an issue will doubt things the next time they hear it. And unfortunately, you hear a lot of range and forecasted increases in the temperatures and things like that, and the average person doesn't know much about weather at all. I mean, the chances are that the average person just was taught cloud types when they were going through school. I think if the media can stick to the main issue is what are humans doing to affect global warming, and not how bad things might be if something happens based on one person's research or based on another's. I think it would do a much better service to educating the public.
Yeah, as I look back, I mean, it is confusing. It's unless a person is focused, as you have been, in really concentrating and focusing on weather. I look back, and as you say, there's legacy storms. I can recall when the Mississippi River was just absolutely over its banks because of rain. And a person looks at that and says, well, that had to be a record moment. But the kind of the question is, do these storms seem to be intensifying, even if incrementally or slowly over time or in their frequency? And I agree as well, the media brings, we're much more conscious of this because we have the 24/7 news cycle that, and it's a big story, so we're hearing about weather and as well seeing the images, which are astonishing these days.
Right. And you know, I think in some respects, the coverage of being able to see how bad people have it when a bad storm comes ashore is important. But I think there is a danger with telling someone that the last hurricane season was due to global warming, because what might happen is that in 10 years we may get into one of these cycles of hurricane minimums, and this person's going to go, well, why are we having, 10 storms a season now if we have global warming? Because, that will happen just because of the variability of weather. You will have an incredibly cold outbreak in the coming years that will set all-time record lows somewhere, and the person's going to look at that and go, well, if there's global warming, why did that happen? And I think that's where I come with the notion that pinning an event is dangerous, because you're going to get an event that doesn't support your conclusions. And then what do you do then? Then you've confused the person who doesn't know much about weather, and you've given ammo for the person who says that global warming doesn't exist, because surely when there's a cold outbreak and we have the coldest January on record somewhere, someone's going to publicize that and say, and they said there was global warming.
Well, that's why I always say global weirding, because
right.
It's going to be very localized, and some people are going to be experiencing excessive heat. Some people are going to be experiencing excessive cold. Some people drought. Some people radical changes in rainfall and much heavier rainfalls, because the weather is probably the most complex system for anybody to really try to understand. I know the government has these big Cray computers that they keep trying to increase their power to try to figure out what the weather is doing, and they're doing a pretty good job these days. But now, from your perspective, now I know, for example, the Houston is flooding. That's kind of in the news right now. Have you been there? Are you familiar with that particular developing story?
Right. Yeah. The rainfall along the Gulf Coast, actually, the Gulf climatologically, and this goes back hundreds of years, is always the first place that tropical weathers will form. There's very, very few storms that form outside of the Western Caribbean or the Gulf outside in the June time period.
Well, those warm weathers kind of increase the passion in every sense of the word. It's more passionate weather, even, perhaps.
Right. And the Gulf is will have these tropical impulses that will combine with maybe an area of mid-latitude energy that comes down, because still in late May and June you get these little pieces of energy that drops out of Canada and it finds its way drifting into the Gulf, and these things kind of combine themselves to produce, basically you get the low-level tropical moisture and then a little energy from a storm that was more mid-latitude based, and you get a combination of very slow flow of winds in the upper levels to guide this energy anywhere, and it just will rain and rain and rain, and the coast is a perfect area for a convergence of winds. You get winds off the water that converge with winds off the land, and then you get a rising motion right there, and with very slow moving storms. So that generally you will see the first tropical system form in the Gulf, which is what happened. It was actually the Western Caribbean, but it went into the Gulf. That's kind of expected. And you will also see these impulses that will attempt to become a tropical system, and they have some tropical characteristics that will drift inland, and with very little motion you'll get, you know, they had 5 to 15 inches of rain, and they were getting 3 or 4 inches an hour at Houston at some point. That it's not terribly uncommon, actually, to see that along the Gulf Coast this time of year.
I mean, so we're hearing about Houston right now. I don't have any knowledge about Houston's rainfall patterns historically. Does this seem to be an aberration?
Their wettest months are in June and July and August, and it's mostly from this type of tropical moisture that comes off the Gulf. And even if it's not even a hurricane or something, it will be something loosely tropically linked that will do this. So, and in general, this amount of rain is unusual, regardless of where it would fall. But, I mean, it falls within some sort of range of getting heavy rain. I mean, this event was probably something that might happen down in Houston every 2 or 3 years.
That's
it's
really
not like a 100-year event or, a 50-year event. I mean, they will get inundating downpours. New Orleans sees it. Most of the Florida Peninsula will see a day or two every 3 or 4 years like this day where they will get 8, 9, 10 inches of rain, and it would be from some sort of tropical energy that came out of the Gulf, very slow moving, and just dumped and dumped rain on them.
You know, here's a question. Now, I think about sunspots because the sun has a cycle of about 11 years,
mm-hmm.
where there's an increasing sunspot activity and then a decreasing sunspot activity. And I believe a lot of people suggest that there is a correlation between sunspot activity and weather patterns on the Earth. Am I heading in the right direction?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of research on it needs more because there are some loosely based links to El Nino cycles and sunspots and general drought conditions and things like that. But there's not a lot of things where you could say, oh, definitely, this is definitely due to sunspots.
I mean, right, it's trends, yeah.
It's like with a lot, I mean, the meteorology is an extremely young science. It's not like physics and astronomy that go back hundreds and hundreds of years. It's in basically its first 100 years right now, and in fact, probably 95% of the good research has been done in the last 30 since computers came along. There's so much work that needs to be done, and you know, these are the type of things that come out when you start doing correlations with weather data and sunspots and other cycles around the Earth. You get some things that stand out, and you go and you take notice, and you go, this is interesting. We see a certain amount of temperature drop in, you know, New England during a sunspot maximum or something like that. And then, you know, you try and correlate it with other places around the world, and then, you know, you get something out of it. And, you know, it's a lot of theory still.
Yeah, the reason I bring it up is that we're heading into another. We kind of reached the low
right.
of sunspot activity last year, and now we're heading into it suddenly increases, and of course that there's some dangers in terms of these solar flares and their magnetic blasts on the planet, where people are talking about the possibility of electronic systems going down. That's for another show. But just the fact that we're heading into now an increase in solar activity, which some people might suggest could increase intensity of storms. Just as an aside here, but it sounds fascinating, you've had a chance to really travel to and chase storms.
Yep.
That's got to be interesting. How in the world do you go about that?
Well, my first chance to do this was here at WeatherBug, we actually chased hurricanes for, you know, a number of years. Now we actually report from afar. We use people who live in the area to do the reporting. But I had a chance to go down to Florida for a couple landfalling storms. And I have to say it was the most amazing experience because Hurricane Gordon came ashore in the Gulf Coast. It was the first hurricane I've ever been through. This was back in 2001, I think. and it was a minimal Category 1 hurricane, and I was amazed at it, at the fierceness of the rainfall and the wind, and it made me think, I can't imagine going through a 2, a 3, a 4, or 5, because 1 was impressive, and that is what woke me up to the power of a hurricane. I mean, the rain felt like nails hitting you in the face. It was coming at such an angle and with such force, it felt like pins hitting you, and you could hardly stand up, and the winds were 55 miles an hour or so, and so being in a stronger storm than that is something that when you realize all these people go through them and they come out so shaken, you're a total believer. I mean, if you haven't had to be in one, consider yourself lucky, but if you do, you'll understand what I'm talking about. The force of a hurricane is amazing.
I was in Florida. I went through a small hurricane, and it was scary. I was in a car driving, and all of a sudden, it just came on relatively suddenly. The weather changed, and then the next thing I know, the trees are starting to really bend. Signs are starting to, you know, go wacky, and then the rains start, and that really gets scary. Now, for you, I can imagine that when you're in the middle of that, you're thinking about all sorts of other things. You're aware of things that others may not be. Do you find yourself...
I mean, what you do is, you know, you can hardly get up in the morning without looking outside, and instead of going, what a beautiful day, you go, oh, I understand why those clouds are there.
Yeah,
I understand why they're the type of cloud they are. And when you experience a hurricane, it's the same thing. It's like the waves of storms, you look at the radar and you kind of like, this type of storm at this point, it's going to get this way and this way and this way. And, you know the structures of the system and how they cycle through bands as they come ashore and gradually intensify. And it's what it ends up being is, hopefully as a forecaster, it validates what you expect, and also ends up being that you're almost picturing the processes going on. I mean, it's an amazing experience, and it's the same thing when I've been tornado chasing and watching a storm form out of a cumulus, and you know how the structure is going and how winds are feeding into this system that you can't see, but you know that this is happening because this is how these storms form, and you expect certain things to happen, and they do, and then you see, you know, a wall cloud form, and, you know, it's really amazing, and it makes you realize, you know, you actually learn something in school.
You know, when you do your tornado chasing, what do? They probably go to an area where you would expect there to be tornadoes at that season, or do you specifically go to an area where a storm is brewing? You have to fly in or something like
that? Actually, the process is we plan it ahead. I mean, what we did is we pick the climatologically the peak time of year, which is the beginning of May for tornadoes in the U.S., and the location. We because planning purposes, we have to book flights and all this months ahead, and we have to get ready for it. So we plan the first week of May. The place in the country that has the most storms is centered around Oklahoma City, so we plan our start point there. But once that day comes and we get there, we may have to drive 12 hours the first day, and we may have to get ourselves to the position where tornadoes are most likely to form. It might be in Nebraska that day.
Hmm.
So we've driven 12 hours to Nebraska, with the next day driving, you know, another 12 hours to the panhandle of Texas, because the weather pattern is changing and certain areas become more suitable for tornadoes. And, you know, it's one thing when you go tornado hunting, it's you're looking for an extremely, extremely unique situation. And you can generally find a thunderstorm, no problem, but finding a thunderstorm that has a higher likelihood of forming a tornado is, you know, a whole nother animal, and you may need to put yourself in a position where you will not see any really good thunderstorms, but you need to be in an area where if one did form, it would have a higher likelihood of a tornado. So a lot of times you spend your time looking at the sky and nothing happens. That happens way more often than not. In fact, I've been on a tornado chase where we didn't, We had one thunderstorm the whole entire 8 days.
Now, what is the balance between relying on probably you're tapped in through to internet lifetime weather information, but as well the visual? I imagine it's a correlation between those two.
Oh yeah, we combine, you know, all those things you mentioned. I mean, we have the internet and we have all the model data and we can look at radar and this and that. We also have our dense network of surface weather stations, which is actually one of the better ways to put yourself in a place that will be conducive before even the clouds develop, because you need to see winds converging at locations, changing directions over short distances, so you can get some sort of rotation in the wind field and some convergence where the wind is rising. So you use surface data, but then again, things start develop and you start seeing the storm undergoing a life cycle, and then it becomes more visual where you're actually watching a storm, you're looking for rotation, you're looking for a wall cloud to develop, you're looking for a whole number of things, as well as looking at radar and seeing how winds are inside the storm and things like that. So, I mean, it's a pretty complicated process, but at some point it is visual where, you know, you're chasing. And, you know, out in the plains, reliable internet connection is, you know, iffy at best sometimes. So you got to make sure you're in a safe place to start, that's for sure.
Well, have you ever... You got nerve. That's all I can say. I grew up in the Midwest, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, where there were plenty of tornadoes. And when you start getting close to one of those things, it is a whole other world. So you got a lot of nerve to try to chase these things. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you wondered if this was really what you wanted to be doing?
You know, it's extremely exciting. It's extremely exciting for me, and being able to use the skills you have to put yourself in a position to see such a rare event. But I have been in situations where you couldn't see anything because there was so much dust being blown in the air, and the rainfall was so heavy that all the skills you've ever learned will not help you figure out if there's something over your head or headed at you. And so, I mean, the main key with tornado chasing is being able to put yourself in a safe position. So if something like that does happen, you're not getting baseball-sized hail rained on your car, or a tornado's not going to come out of a rain shaft suddenly and, you know, it's going to be bearing down on you without any notice. You know, you need to know if a storm develops, what direction it's going to move, and you need to know, do you have a safe way out? You have to have a good maps, good GIS locator on your computer so you can go, you know, if something happens here, what's my best way out? And then you got to be able to say, I don't need to get any closer to this storm. So many people think they need to get closer and closer. I've seen storms, plenty of storms where, you know, you don't need to get inside of a mile to get a better look at it.
I've seen these images of some of the storm chasers, and it's all kind of a relative thing, because you have this enormous system that is crossing, and it looks as if it's just kind of puddling along, but the winds around that are really enormous. And then someone's on a car or a vehicle on a road, and they're kind of locked into that spot,
mm-hmm.
You know. And so I've often wondered, how in the world do you actually sort of orient yourself to that oncoming event, which, you know, how do you plan which way, where you should be?
Well, you know, there are some chasers that it's like the people who jump out of planes and the people who bungee jump off of bridges. They get this adrenaline rush where, you know, sanity sometimes goes out the window, and they get so involved in what they're doing that they stop thinking about what's safe and what's prudent. And, you know, there are a handful of people out there that take things just a little far. I've seen a number of tornadoes that have dropped down in the road right in front of people.
Wow.
Because they just weren't thinking. They were trying to get too close, and, you know, they put themselves in that situation. And unfortunately, my experience over the last 20 years is that one of these days we're going to see people get killed, and I have this great fear that we're going to see some reporter from some network station get hit by a board during a hurricane because, you know, they want to stand out in the wind. And, you know, the same thing with the pure numbers of people that chase tornadoes. It's like, unfortunately, people try and outdo other people, and some of it's for, you know, ratings and publicity and this and that. And, you know, for me, I think it's only more of a matter of time that a situation, unfortunately, like that is going to happen.
It will happen because these, I mean, as you say, when you're in these storms where the winds are 100 and some miles an hour, you don't know what's coming. And it is just a matter of time. And then they'll probably pass legislation that says that no reporters can go stand out in a storm or something like that, you know. But, well, listen, let's look at this upcoming season. What are your thoughts about hurricane season 2006?
Well, we are definitely in a peak cycle for tropical weather. And with the fact that the overall global patterns are really aligning much the same way they did last year, where we have above normal sea surface temperatures, we're in basically a null phase for El Nino and La Nina, which generally affects the upper level winds. In fact, we're probably a little more toward a La Nina, which would be more favorable for tropical system. The tropical activity this season is going to be much above normal, unfortunately. Now, I would have to say that just based on climatology and averages, we couldn't approach this past season. I mean, the sheer number, it broke records by five or six storms in itself, which is purely amazing. I do believe that we're due for some activity again along the U.S. coast, and it's probably, you know, going to be a busy season again down along the Florida coast, the southeast coast, and probably, you know, some areas of the Gulf Coast. It's hard to pin down any areas. It's very difficult to pin down on landfall storms. But the activity and the favorability of the situation generally definitely lends it toward an active season down there. Now, one thing you have to be careful of, and I've seen forecasts like this where forecasters are pinpointing areas a storm might hit. And I think that's extremely dangerous as well, because you make people who aren't pinpointed maybe, you know, put their guard down, and you raise expectations and fears in areas where people, where they say maybe, you know, this is a year for New England and this and that. You maybe raise that unduly, but the key for any hurricane season is that if you live along the coast or within 100 miles of the coast, is just have a preparation plan and have an evacuation plan and be prepared for it, because it did take 40 years for another hurricane to hit New Orleans. Everyone talked and talked that they were due, but, you know, you could have one hit there this year again. It doesn't necessarily mean that just because they had a storm last year, they're not going to get one this year, and it's not going to be just as bad. So it's better just being safe generally across the East Coast and realize it's a very active season, and to expect storms and expect that there will be some evacuations, and, you know, just everyone should be prepared for that.
2005 set the record for a number of storms, but also the other issue, all it takes is one really bad storm to make history.
Exactly. Hurricane Andrew was in a very quiet hurricane year. In fact, A, being the first storm, it formed in August. It was generally a little bit later than average when you start seeing, you know, the activity ramp up, but it was an extremely bad hurricane. So, you know, like you said, it only takes one. You could have one storm this year, and it could hit, you know, New York City or something, and, you know, it could be the worst hurricane season ever for the U.S. based on dollar damage. Yeah. So,
any sort of trends in terms of kind of size of storm, relative frequency of larger storms, you know, based on kind of the concept of global warming?
You know, this is one of the areas where I believe you know, you have to be careful because of the fact that we have had bad storms in 9 years, and we are in a maximum cycle for hurricanes, and there are some things going on that are tough to link. I mean, most meteorologists will not pin the strength of these storms on global warming. We're just not prepared to do that at this time.
Well, that's what science, you know, that's how science works. And there are people who work by instinct.
Hey, and, you know, over the next few, over the coming years, there is a lot of research going on that right now, and something more definitive may come out of it, but I think it's a little too early to pin an event like this. It probably would cause more confusion than good in speculating on that.
So. Hey, here's a final question. When does a person have to really pay attention? I mean, we hear about storms and things, but what is it that they have to hear where they go, you know, I guess this may be, I really have to take this seriously. I really have to guard and perhaps evacuate. Is there something that's sort of a trigger that people should be aware of?
I think the Hurricane Center does a fantastic job with their warnings, and there's a reason why they do such a strongly coordinated effort with their warnings and talking to emergency managers. Because they know how long it's going to take to evacuate a barrier island, and people should, if they're told 48 hours ahead to evacuate, you know, they should evacuate and not, you know, wait and say, you know, I'm going to wait another 12 hours and see if the storm might turn or this or that. There's a whole host of reasons as to why the timing is put on the warnings issued by the Hurricane Center, and it's almost totally in has to do with safety. It doesn't have near as much to do with the fact that they think the storm might hit in that location. They're more concerned is if it does hit there, will I be able to get all the people off of this island or away from the coast and up the highways to a safe place where they're not stuck in traffic like they were in Houston last year? And, you know, those type of things are what drives the hurricane warnings. And when they do issue those watches and warnings and evacuations and this and that, people should listen to them because there are very, very strong reasons behind why they're saying those things. It's not just because they're forecasting weather. And just because you hear this cone of uncertainty in a hurricane that it might go to the left and it might go to the right, you know, that's something that also just confuses the public. They should say, I live here. They're telling me to evacuate, and then they should do it.
You know, Mark Hoeksema, who's the chief meteorologist with WeatherBug.com, you're a great spokesman. A wonderful conversation here.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, too.
You bet. Listen, tell us about a little bit about WeatherBug. What if people go to WeatherBug, what are they going to find?
Well, for the average person, what you get at WeatherBug is you get a desktop application that runs on your taskbar against all those other little icons you have on the lower right. And and you get access to real-time weather data from one of our 8,000 weather stations. And we have huge numbers of weather stations that people will quite possibly find just a few miles down the road or their kid's school has it, and they can get data that pertains to them. They're not going to get the airport data from 20 miles away. You put in your zip code. You end up getting the weather. You get a radar image centered over you. You get your forecast for your house. You get satellite imagery. You get the live data. You can look up travel forecasts. I mean, virtually anything you need to plan your day, your weekend, your trip to the beach and all that. You know, the WeatherBug just sits there quietly. And most importantly, it monitors your zip code for alerts. So if the weather service issues a severe thunderstorm warning for you, it will chirp in the corner and blink, and you'll click on it, and it'll tell you of any impending weather headed your way, whether it be high winds, hurricanes like we talked about, tornado warnings, severe thunderstorms, and you don't have to go searching around the web for it. We're pushing all this information to you. There's no need to go to some website and search for the forecast or for a radar image or whatnot. Everything's, you know, one click away, pretty much, and people can pretty much just let us do the work for them as far as finding their weather and getting them the accurate forecast.
You guys offer a free download. I'm going to do that because this is, as they say, the century of the weather. What better way to really keep informed about
what's
going on?
And we also cover the weather in our news and features section. So the people who have a real strong interest in the latest developments and research, we publish that stuff. We write our own stories, for example, about the Houston rain that we talked about. You could have read about our coverage on that and the rain and when it was going to end and the effects of it. And so there's a lot of good news information available as well through the product.
Mark Hoeksema, Chief Meteorologist for WeatherBug.com. Thanks a lot. You've been a great addition to our show.
Well, I appreciate it. It was nice talking with you.
Seems weather and water are synonymous. Thank God for the grand wonder of the water cycles, because it makes life possible all over the planet. Or at least, that's what's supposed to happen. But a recent Supreme Court decision just may put a dam across the river of life. Stay tuned.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here we go. It's Supreme Court time. And this week, the umpires of power handed down a 5-4 decision that could take that good old tried-and-true water cycle and just eliminate it and replace it with dirt and sand and houses and shopping malls. It's a free fall into free markets when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This last week, the Supreme Court made a decision. We hear about Supreme Court decisions all the time, and this one is one that I'm sure snuck below the radar screen, many radar screens, because it had to do with the Clean Water Act. And for a lot of people, this kind of it just slips right by them. But actually, this may have tremendous significance for public lands and private lands, which probably is the main issue. So a 5-4 Supreme Court decision having to do with a case that dealt with water rights. This is a very complex issue. These water rights issues are, because water has its own mind. It goes where it wants to. Fortunately, it serves us all because it keeps us all alive. And so where water goes and how it gets there and what may block it has terrific significance to many living things. To help us understand why this is important to us, we're now talking with John Devine, who is an attorney with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. John, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
This is a complex issue. This has to do with the courses of water, natural water, and give us a sense of why this has significance.
Sure. Well, what the cases involve are what kinds of water bodies the Clean Water Act will apply to, and that's all of the protections of the Clean Water Act, which protects waterways from sewage, from industrial toxins, and from oil spills, from being filled in altogether by dredge and fill material.
I think the most critical element here is what constitutes a waterway, a protected waterway, and otherwise designated a wetland. Help us understand how that has been determined and why that's important in this case.
What's at issue in these cases is what constitutes a water of the United States, which are protected by the Clean Water Act and have been since 1972. What the court ultimately wasn't able to reach agreement about is exactly what waters meet that definition. That's unfortunate because we were hoping for some clarity from the Supreme Court about what waters would be protected, and more to the point, we were hoping that the court would confirm a long-standing view that waters broadly are protected by the Clean Water Act, not certain special kinds of waters.
Well, this case revolves around, actually, I don't know if it's two separate cases. Is it two separate cases?
It was two separate cases. Mm-hmm.
But they had a related point in law.
Exactly.
And this was brought by John A. Rapinos and June Carabel. These are the two defendants in this case? How does this work in this situation?
In the Supreme Court, they're called petitioners. But, yes, they had each lost in the Court of Appeals below, and in both cases the Court of Appeals had said that the wetlands that they were proposing, or in Mr. Rapinos's case had developed, they were requesting that those not be considered waters of the United States and therefore not be protected by the Clean Water Act.
Now, these are two people who own property, and there's nothing that, you know, we all want to own property. And, of course, this is, I think, where this war is really raging, and that is the rights of a property owner to do what they want with their land. You know, if a person, particularly if they're in business, if they invest in property, which we all invest in property, our homes are business property in a sense, because we can make a lot of money off of these kinds of things. Some people buy land because they want to develop it, and that's the case here. Both of these people had intentions to develop their lands, and so they had an economic interest in using the land, and so they proceeded to do that. They started to develop the lands, and in the case of Mr. Rapinos, he actually started to alter his lands, and maybe give us a little background on what happened and why that's important.
What these particular cases involve are wetlands that are next to tributaries to the Great Lakes. And what Mr. Rapinos did was to actually undertake activity at some of his sites to drain and fill in the wetlands there. The other case involved a person named Carabel who had proposed to do something similar. Obviously, the filling in of wetlands or the draining of them is important for the tributaries right there and for the larger water bodies that they lead into. Those wetlands provide habitat for resident and migratory animals. They filter pollution before it gets to larger water bodies and hurts what lives there and it impairs drinking water that we all use, and these wetlands also provide significant flood water storage. Taking the law into your own hands is something that we should discourage. And instead, what the government had argued and what we supported was that these wetlands ought to be considered protected by the Clean Water Act, and these folks ought to obtain a permit before filling them in. That would ensure that they did the least damage to the water resource possible.
Now, a lot of their case rested on interpretation of words such as navigable and tributary. I think perhaps they were trying to make the case that these waters really weren't of any significance in terms of becoming a tributary to the larger bodies of water. And that's kind of where this point of law becomes minusculated. It just becomes, there's a lot of minutiae in that. Help us understand what their case.
I think they were primarily trying to argue that the Clean Water Act, at least Mr. Rapinos was trying to argue that the Clean Water Act only applies to water bodies that you can float a boat in that are navigable. The Supreme Court roundly rejected that, and fortunately so. That would taking navigable waters to be the only protected waters under the Clean Water Act would be a tremendous loophole in the law. It would cut out at something near 60% of the stream miles in the lower 48 states. Unfortunately, the court did step back from traditionally broad coverage of the Clean Water Act, and that took a couple forms. Justice Scalia, who was joined by three other justices, would have gone very far and cut out waterways that did not have a continuous and relatively permanent flow in them, and especially in the West, those are quite common. There are nearly 2 million miles of such waterways in the lower 48. Justice Kennedy, on the other hand, suggested that before the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers could protect a water, that they would have to show somehow that the water in question was biologically or chemically important to the overall aquatic system, and that's going to create some procedural hurdles in practice, which we're a little, we're troubled by.
I guess their case also suggests that, I guess in one case, their property was 20 miles away from the nearest lake. Is that right? 20 miles? Something like that?
That is the case at one of, I believe, one of Mr. Rapanos' properties. But the point to bear in mind here is that the wetland that was there also abutted a tributary to the Great Lakes. And as my 6-year-old understands, when pollution is put into a smaller water body, it flows downstream to the larger one.
That's the way it works. Water flows downstream. That's exactly right. And as well, it percolates into the ground and forms the basis of our water tables. And
absolutely. If you pollute streams that serve as drinking water sources for us, that creates costs for cleanup and endangers public health.
So just to kind of reiterate, it seems what the Supreme Court did was it reversed a case, a ruling that was against these defendants in the lower courts, therefore, in essence, reversing the constraints that were placed upon them to not change or alter their designated wetland, the areas that were considered wetlands by law, by the lower courts. And so what this, in essence, does, or perhaps in fact, is it suddenly opens up a tremendous number of potential situations where people are dredging their wetlands and filling in wetland areas because now they have the protection of law. Is that right?
I think it remains to be seen.
Well, good point. I'm just saying it could lead to that.
Fortunately, Justice Scalia, who would have dramatically opened up the Clean Water Act with his view of the law, only got three justices to join him, so that view of the law did not command a majority of the Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy had a much more narrow view of what EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers have to do to protect waters before, and so that is still troubling because I think it creates practical problems for people who want to protect waters, but it's certainly not the wholesale gutting that I think you would have seen if Justice Scalia's view had prevailed.
Well, now this is interesting. I just learned something, I think. Then, and that is that in the decisions of these courts, depending on, because the Supreme Court justices actually do interpret their rulings, that therefore this ruling becomes nuanced because it is a split decision.
That's right. There's a fractured opinion here, basically. There are four justices for a big new loophole. There are four justices who would have upheld the Clean Water Act's protections to these water bodies, and there's Justice Kennedy in the middle. As a result, I think we're going to see a lot more individual case-by-case fights and unfortunately additional litigation over which waters are going to be protected. And that's why we think that Congress, who after all wrote the Clean Water Act 30-some years ago and knows what it meant in doing so, ought to step in and clear up the rules.
I don't think we should hold our breath on that. It's pretty obvious that the court decision followed the conservative and liberal lines in this case. So what it ultimately means is there is no clear decision, and
that's
therefore
right.
There's going to be a lot of indecision in terms of our future here. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, but Congress can fix that, and I'll put in a plug again, because there are bills in both houses that have already been introduced and would fix the confusion that the Supreme Court has unfortunately sent back to the agencies and to the lower courts.
Now, do you know who's introducing those bills?
There's a in the House there are some 150 some co-sponsors of a bill called the Clean Water Authority Restoration Act, and that's roughly a dozen folks on the Senate side. The bill would simply reaffirm the protections that the Clean Water Act has provided for 30 some years. It would specify that EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers would need to protect the waters that had been protected for decades.
Does this come down sort of fundamentally to this ancient old battle that goes on between protections that are set up for the public good versus protections that are set up for the private good, the personal protections for property? It does sort of come down to that, doesn't it? Because, I mean, the water is this thing that crosses many, many properties. That's probably where the conflict arises. So is it sort of based on that?
Well, yes. I mean, frequently a polluter will be a private property owner or a developer who's trying to fill in a water on his or her property. But as you point out, that's not where these issues stop. Water is a shared resource, and pollution added on somebody's property to a stream that flows through many properties and ultimately to larger bodies of water affect many people downstream. Millions of us get our drinking water from small streams and rivers, and it is imperative that we be able to protect those from individuals who would otherwise pollute them. And what the Clean Water Act does is simply say, before you add pollution or fill in a protected water, you have to get a permit that minimizes your impact.
Is there anything that you feel people can actually do?
They certainly can urge that Congress enact the Clean Water Authority Restoration Act, which would protect the waters that have historically been protected by the Clean Water Act. And they can also, you know, take action at the local level. They can make sure that their own neighborhood and nearby streams are being looked after, and that people aren't abusing them.
John Devine, who works with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, you guys are really at the forefront so often of these kinds of cases. And if it weren't for you, I don't know who'd be doing this type of thing, because individuals really can't take on these cases. So tell us a little bit about the NRDC and how people can find out more about what you folks are doing.
Sure. NRDC is a nationwide organization of members. We have over a million members and online activists. We have offices in California, New York, and Washington, D.C., and we're online at www.nrdc.org.
John Devine with the NRDC, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much, Sydney.
I wonder, really, if it's smart to take all the wisdom and wonder of God and the planets and moon and stars that spun this little earthly haven into being and rip it apart and sell it off in chunks. People need to take a stand, really, speak up, stand up, speak out, unite, and serve as the strong arms of truth. We keep it coming every week, the voice of the earth, your voices of the earth. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios, until we meet again, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth calls out, here on the Wild Side News.
Shadows and footprints mirror the movements of moon and tide. Magnificent families glide perfectly calm. Nurturing children, why must we kill them with thoughtless hands? They're part of a perfect plan, and brother to man. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand? Oh, creatures on sea and land, before it's too late. Shadows and footprints, shadows and footprints, shadows and footprints. Thank you.